Hi there. Thank you for joining us yet again on another episode of Space Nuts. My name is Andrew Dunkley, your host, and good to have your company. Got a couple of things to talk about on today's show. Not all good news, I'm afraid. One in relation to Saturn's moon Titan. They've released some new information about the potential for life on Titan, and that doesn't augur well, unfortunately. They've been crunching the numbers and looking at the elephants, and they've basically come up with an elephant in a room that they don't like the look of. That all makes sense, promise you that. And we are also going to the United Nations because there's been an agreement to talk about something that needs to be talked about so that they can talk about it again and then maybe make a decision about talking about whatever they're going to talk about at the first meeting that they're going to talk about. That'll all make sense as well. That's all coming up on this episode of Space Nuts.
15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 10, 9. Ignition sequence start.
Space Nuts.
5, 4, 3, 2.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Space Nuts. Astronauts report it feels good.
And joining me to unravel, quite literally, all of that is Professor Fred Watson, astronomer at large. Hello, Fred.
Hello, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm confused.
Well, join the club.
Yes. No, I'm all right. I'm all right. Are you okay?
Yeah, much better than I have been. Thank you. Now that the antibiotics have got rid of the... it's technically called rickettsia, but it's usually also known as spotted fever.
Mm.
That describes it perfectly. And it was caused by a tick bite.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That is nasty. It's been a long haul, really, hasn't it? I mean,
it has. It's been about 3 weeks altogether.
Nasty. Let us get stuck into the news of this episode. And our first story concerns Titan. Now, Titan held a lot of promise in terms of potential life because we know that it's got all those elements for creating life, plus, probably a subterranean ocean or a sub-ice ocean that could, mean that the mix is right to create potentially life. And, of course, there's a big mission going there in the not-too-distant future. And the people who published this study were actually a little bit worried that what they discovered might, put a torpedo in the mission. But it's probably going to do the opposite for other reasons. But let's sort of just get down to tin tacks. Titan probably looked like one of the best prospects for life beyond Earth, and now they're starting to suggest that's probably not true. What's happened?
I think this the kind of slightly depressing bit of this is that it may well be that what has been evaluated for Titan will apply to the other ice moons like Europa and Enceladus and now Mimas, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which all have sub-ice oceans. This is a study by an astrobiologist, Catherine Nish, and what she's shown is that... The sub-ice ocean on Titan. So remember the model of Titan. It's a rocky world. It's a big world. It's bigger than Mercury, which has an ocean overlaying the rock and ice on the surface of that. And on the surface of the ice, there are other liquids, which are liquid hydrocarbons. That's another story, which we might touch on in a minute as well. But what Catherine has done is looked at how material from the surface of Titan, which is known to be rich in hydrocarbons, how that might filter down to the subsurface ocean. And basically the outcome is that it is very, very slow indeed. Not something that might make for a prebiotic mix in the oceans of Titan, the sub-ice ocean. I hope I'm putting that succinctly. But basically the story is this. Excuse me. And I should say this study is published in the journal Astrobiology. It's all about how, this transfer from the surface which is known to be organic rich, down to the ocean. And so what has what the modelling looks at is the fact that comets, which will have impacted Titan like they have done the Earth, and probably more so in the early history of Titan, comet hits the surface. The heat of impact melts the surface, so you've got a pool of liquid water for a little while that's got the surface organics mixed with it. And what she has done then is said, OK, first of all, how many comets are going to strike Titan every year? And that gives you an idea of the flow of water rate carrying these organics from the surface to the interior. But then to work out just how they will get down through the ice. I mean, there are all kinds of unknowns in this, I have to say, Andrew, because we don't actually know how thick that ice layer is. And we don't know what the kind of consistency of what's underneath it is. It may be a sort of slush because we're talking about very low temperatures. But that ocean is known to exist because of this phenomenon of if you stand on Titan, your longitude changes. And that's because the surface is moving with respect to the interior core. Mm. Anyway, what they discovered was that every year, I think it's every year. Let me just make sure I'm saying the right thing here. Yeah, so this is every year. Every year you would get roughly 7.5 tons of glycine, which is the simplest of the amino acids and is one of the constituents of proteins in living organisms. and I'll leave you to draw the line with the elephant there, but the 7.5 tons of glycine are going to filter down to the ocean. Now, the ocean is, we think, at least 12 times the volume of the Earth's ocean. So 7.5 tons per year into that isn't going to cut the mustard when it comes to forming life.
Which is the equivalent to the mass of an African male elephant.
That's
where we're drawing the analogy.
That's the elephant in the room.
Yes,
that's right. So one elephant's worth of glycine per year going into an ocean 12 times the volume of Earth's oceans, you can see the difficulty there,
yeah,
can't you?
Yeah.
It's going to be very, very dilute indeed. Now, that's for a world that is rich in surface organics, surface chemicals containing carbon, whereas the other icy worlds that were just mentioned, Europa, Ganymede, Enceladus, they've virtually no carbon compounds on their surface. And so, you know, if Titan's subsurface moon is not going to be habitable because of this very poor flow of good stuff down from the surface, then it's going to be worse for the other, you know, the other ocean worlds, the other ice moons of the solar system. Catherine Nish summarized it very nicely. This work shows that it is very hard to transfer the carbon on Titan's surface to its subsurface ocean. Basically, it's hard to have both the water and the carbon needed for life in the same place. And so that's, as you said, there is still much to learn about Titan. The Dragonfly mission, which will launch a double quad copter lander on Titan 2028. It's not that far down the track.
No.
It's going to take a few years to get there, but that'll be exciting when it happens. So we're still excited about Titan, but this kind of is a bit of a downer when it comes to the sub-ice ocean.
Well, the question for me is, how do they know they're most likely to be right? Because they've had to make assumptions on several levels in releasing this paper. They've had to assume a certain number of comets, a certain amount of material. And how do we know that the interior of the planet didn't already contain all that?
Exactly. That is a very good question. Because like all science, you're working on assumptions.
Mm.
You're making these assumptions about what what the constituents are. The assumptions are always based on the best understanding that we have, but may not be the right answer. And that's the beauty of science. You know, something might turn up next week that says, oh, wait a minute, we've got the comet flux wrong. Oh, wait a minute, we've done the maths wrong.
Yeah.
That's not usually the maths that have been done wrong. It's usually that one of the assumptions might change because of new discoveries.
Mm.
So it's like all, particularly astrobiology, you're pulling together strands from many, many different fields of science. And you're making a conclusion on the basis of that.
Now, you did mention liquid hydrocarbons on the surface. So what's the story? I know that exists, but how is it relevant to this story?
Well, my take on this is less pessimistic because one of the things that has excited astrobiologists in the past, certainly in the early days of the Cassini-Huygens mission when we landed a spacecraft on the surface of Titan, the fact that so the argument that Nish and her colleagues are making are very much on standard biology as we know it. It's water-based life with carbon as the, carbon-based life with water as the working fluid. And that's certainly true of all life that we know. We know of nothing that works differently. But there have been speculations that you could have a different basis of life. And there were certainly ideas put forward back in the early 2000s, which suggested that maybe there were organisms, again, carbon-based organisms, but ones that use liquid natural gas as their working fluid, the ethane and methane, which might breathe hydrogen and eat acetylene, which is another carbon-containing compound.
Mm.
And there was a little bit of a flush of excitement about that when Cassini discovered that both acetylene and carbon... Sorry, acetylene and hydrogen, I beg your pardon, they're both depleted near the surface of these hydrocarbon lakes. Now, that observation might have gone away. It's not something I've heard about for a long time. But it does mean that we shouldn't limit ourselves to looking at life as we know it, Jim, because that's, you know, water-based... carbon-based life on a water working fluid. There might be other possibilities, and Titan might be a place where they exist.
Yeah. Okay. So we can't absolutely write it off, but the evidence based on certain mathematical assumptions does sort of tip a bit of water, boom, boom, on the Titan theory.
Cold water is, yeah. Too. Definitely cold water.
I think I've got a solution, though. Let's go to Titan and build a room. I reckon if we go in inside that room, we will find an elephant.
On its way down through the ice.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. It's got to be a bit of a disappointment for people, even though they're saying, oh, no, this new horizon, the Dragonfly, mission, we'll go ahead. We're still excited. There's so many more questions to answer.
Well, that's right.
But it's got to be a bit of a gut punch to hear this.
Yes. Mm. It's science. Yeah, it's science. You know, we roll with the falls, is that it? But, you know, and once again, Titan is of vast interest, not just because of the possibility of there being life there. It's of huge interest. It's unique. It's the only world in the entire universe that we know, other than the Earth, where there are pools of liquid, and it's hydrocarbons rather than water, which are in equilibrium with the atmosphere. So you've got this weather cycle there. You get carbon... methane and ethane rain. There will be, Andrew, get this, there will be methane and ethane rainbows on Titan, which will have a different radius from rainbows on Earth because it's water that causes our water droplets that cause our rainbows. It'll be methane-ethane droplets that cause theirs, and they've got different refractive indices. So stuff like that is going to be fabulous for Dragonfly.
Yeah. Well, how long is that going to take to get there, though?
Yeah, that's the problem. A long time.
Yeah. So even though the launch is, 2028, by the time it gets there and it gets down to business, it'll be much, much later.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the orbital trajectory is. There'll be slingshots involved, I'm sure, but I don't know what the details are. Anyway, something still to look forward to. And it's not, you know, it's an interesting comment. I see it as a comment on our journey towards seeking life elsewhere in the universe.
Indeed. All right. If you'd like to read that story in full, you can find it on the SciTech Daily website. This is Space Nuts. Andrew Dunkley here with Professor Fred Watson. Let's take a short break from the show to tell you about our sponsor, NordVPN. Now, I've talked to you very, very regularly about virtual private networks and the benefits that you gain, particularly if you're using Wi-Fi devices in a public place to protect you from scammers or hackers or, you know, just generally protect you in an overall sense. But another thing that I've claimed in the past is the speed at which NordVPN can operate, even when you're using a server in another country. So I'm going to prove it. Right now, I'm going to do a speed test on my own internet service. I have not got NordVPN connected right at this moment. So I'll pick the server. Let me just change it to the one I use regularly. Okay, so I'm going from my server to another server. No VPN, speed test. And we'll do a check on how fast my internet service is. Okay, so there it's pushing up just over 100 megabits per second download as it is. All right, just peaked at 106 actually. So I'm getting more than I'm paying for through my standard service. And the upload speed is around 40. Okay, righto. Let's stop that. And now we're going to do it via NordVPN. So I'll open my server and I will click the quick connect. So it'll pick its own server to connect through while I'm doing this. And it only takes a few seconds. And then we are connected. So we've connected to Australian server number 653. I'll have to close the browser and open it again so that it gets a fresh connection via the VPN. And then we will do a speed test, all right? Speed test. And I'll use exactly the same server so that we can compare the numbers. Can you remember what I said before? find the optimal server. All right, I'm going to change it to, where did it go? There it is, that one. So once again, of course, the server that I'm going through now is different from my regular server because I'm using a VPN. So click go. Let's see what the numbers say. And boom, 99, 100. Yeah, so what have I lost? There, 102. I've lost practically nothing, 103. So around the 102, 103 megabits per second download. So I'm still getting more than I'm paying for, and the upload is continuing to hang around the 36, 37 megabits per second. That's with the VPN connected. So that's NordVPN. It offers high-speed access to their service. You don't lose anything in the translation, maybe 1 or 2 megabits per second. Sometimes it's even faster than your regular connection. It is a great service. It's well worth getting, not only for your peace of mind, but also for your continuity of service. And I stand by it. I've been using it for a very long time, very happy with it, and all those other services that go with it that I find really valuable. So where do you get it? All right, nordvpn.com/spacenuts. That's nordvpn.com/spacenuts. There's a special deal for you, heavily discounted price, an extra 4 months. And it's their birthday, so they're offering all sorts of bells and whistles along the way. Check it all out at nordvpn.com/spacenuts and click get the deal. And don't forget, they have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Now back to the show.
0G and I feel fine.
Space Nuts.
The second half of our program, Fred, is dedicated to bureaucracy.
not entirely.
I'm probably being a bit too tough, but it's finally come to pass that the United Nations has put on an agenda for a meeting later this year that they will be looking into the issue of concentrations of satellites or satellite constellations or whatever you want to call them. Because as we speak, there are over 8,000 satellites in orbit around Earth, and there are plans to send up many, 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 many more. Even Rwanda wants to get in on this. They announced a few years ago now that they wanted to put 300,000 satellites in orbit. SpaceX wants to put 60,000 up there, and there are so many others that want to add to that number. And it's starting, well, it's beyond becoming a concern for those who use visual telescopes and radio telescopes, because you want to keep the skies dark and quiet, and having hundreds of thousands of satellites orbiting the planet or in geostationary orbit probably would make that difficult.
It's a challenge. So this story goes back really to 2029. Sorry, doesn't go back to 2029. See, I'm still not quite well enough.
I felt very old there for a moment.
Yeah, it goes back to 2019, in fact, May 2019, when the first tranche of Starlink satellites were launched. And astronomers were taken by surprise when they realised that SpaceX had approval for another 12,000 of them, they started to get upset. So that's the backstory. Now, this is a story that I've been very closely involved with, Andrew, because it's part of my job to help to counter this issue. And since that time, there's been a lot has happened. Astronomers grumbled like mad to start with, but they have since then had many, many conferences, done a lot of work on actually evaluating the risk to astronomical observation. And you're quite right, it's both optical telescopes and radio telescopes which are affected by this. So all of that has led a couple of years ago to the formation by the International Astronomical Union, which is the sort of governing body of astronomy, of something that is called the Centre for the Protection of the Dark and Quiet Sky from the Effects of Satellite Constellations, usually abbreviated to the CPS. It's a lot easier to say. In fact, it's a lot of colleagues and friends of mine who are involved with that. So that's at one level. And that organisation, the CPS, one of its it does many things. It does, you know, works out how you can remediate observations that have been affected by satellite transmissions, whether they're radio or satellite reflections in the case of optical telescopes. They've done a huge amount of work on that. There is also a strong part of the organisation which is about liaising with the space industry, which in the bottom line is one of the most important ones, because the space industry is the key to this, and in particular the biggest, basically the person or the organisation with the most investment in this so far is SpaceX with Starlink, and I'm very glad to say that SpaceX has been one of the foremost, if not the foremost company, to engage with astronomers and look at the problems and how you fix them. And indeed, there are some really good people working within the Starlink organization who are actually also members of the CPS, the IAU Center. So there's a lot of there's a good news aspect to this story. The less good news aspect was something I was closely involved with this time last year. I was just returning from a couple of weeks in Vienna, where the Science and Technical Subcommittee of the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space had just finished its annual two-week meeting. And during that meeting, we were very kind of urgently trying to get this issue of the deleterious effects of satellite constellations on astronomy onto the agenda, the permanent agenda of COPWAS, the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. that proved difficult because everything in the UN works by consensus. It's not a vote. Everybody has to agree. And there were certain nations which would not agree to this agenda item. And I came away.
Was the United States one of them?
The United States was not one of them. It was other countries who were constantly in the news because of wars and things of that sort.
Right.
It was all about, it was all about trying to push this through. We were very disappointed at the end of that couple of weeks that we didn't make it through with the agenda item. There was a full meeting of the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, rather than their scientific and technical subcommittee, which is what I was all involved with. That full committee met in June, and the hope was that they would push it forward there too. That didn't happen either because of another country that objected. In fact, that's where it stood. And you might remember, but in October, I was at a meeting in La Palma in the Canary Islands, which was actually an International Astronomical Union meeting where we discussed this again. And there were glimmers of hope there that we could see a way forward to take this issue onto the agenda of the UN. And okay, so in the meeting that's just gone, which I wasn't at, and in fact it was an in-person only meeting, so I couldn't even log in online, but my colleagues from the Australian Space Agency were there, fantastic people who are right across this issue. And in the end, it was agreed. So there is actually a very nice International Astronomical Union press release, which is headed, as you said, United Nations agrees to address the impact of satellite constellations on astronomy. And so the agenda item, which will come up now for the next 5 years, and that is pretty amazing for UN issues, has the title Dark and Quiet Skies, Astronomy and Large Constellations, Addressing Emerging Issues and Challenges. And I hope that I might be involved with that work down the track. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen, but it's certainly very close to my heart to be able to do that. So that's a step forward. Now, as you have kind of indicated at the start of this segment, the wheels of the UN turn very slowly indeed. And this is an issue on which essentially nimbleness is really the watchword because, the industry is moving ahead so quickly. But I do believe that what the UN agreement now will do is it just adds that little bit more gravitas to what we're already doing in the astronomy world, engaging with the space industry, looking at how things can be improved and how we can mitigate the effects of these mega constellations. Because the bottom line is the mega constellations are actually doing good things. They are providing internet services where they would never have been there before. And we've seen examples with the wars that are going on at the moment, how those services are invaluable. There is the industry itself, I should just add as a postscript to this, is concerned about the crowding of space because, the Kessler syndrome haunts us all. One big collision and you've suddenly got so much debris that space becomes unusable.
Exactly. Yeah. I have a devil's advocate question. Okay. The UN's now agreed to put this on the agenda and discuss it and look at the problem over the next 5 years. How much power have they got to actually deal with it when the time comes? Well, the time has come, but how much power have they got?
So they do have power in the sense that it may well be that another body that sort of sits under the UN, which is the International Telecommunications Union, and that's the body that actually allocates frequencies and basically says, yes, you can launch your spacecraft. And there is thinking, which I think is shared across the board, that their mandate needs to be tightened up, that the ITU needs some revision in the way it deals with requests for orbital launches and orbital slots, and that can be done. That's something that will probably be encouraged by the fact that this agenda item has gone ahead. If I may just segue from that, Andrew, to another story that kind of highlights really what we're talking about, and that is the announcement again from SpaceX that they are going to deorbit 100 of its older Starlink satellites in order to sort of clear the air a bit. It's to basically get rid of a threat for collisions, because I think these are the older, I think this is among the first group of the Starlink satellites. They're what are called the version one satellites.
Yeah.
And so over the next few weeks, they're going to deorbit 100 of them. Now, exactly as you've said, Starlink already has more than 5,000 of these in orbit. But the later versions are actually, I think, more sophisticated in their collision avoidance capabilities and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
SpaceX announced in an X tweet, if I mix my metaphors there, that this is the right thing to do to keep space safe and sustainable, which is really what it's all about. And I have to say, and I've said this already, but yes, SpaceX, their Starlink constellations are certainly the biggest offenders in terms of numbers, but they are also the ones that have come closest to the party by things like the VisorSats, which were aiming to darken the satellites. We now have reflective coatings on the satellites that can deflect the beams of light from the sun, rather than those beams being scattered down to Earth where they become visible in twilight. You beam them straight out into space and make the satellites invisible. It reduces their brightness. And they're also engaging in some quite stringent mitigation properties in regard to radio astronomy as well. So in that regard, it's a good news story. It is one that's still a difficulty. Mm. Astronomy will never be the same again with all this satellite constellation interference. But we're learning how to deal with it, and I think forging very good relationships with the space industry. I hope the space industry is listening to this.
Yes,
because
I hope so too. Yes,
we're fans.
Let's hope the UN works faster than our roads and traffic authorities here in New South Wales, who have just agreed that we should register horse-drawn vehicles.
Okay. Right.
I can't help myself sometimes. Mm. It is interesting news, and you can find out more at the internationalastronomicalunion.org website. That wraps it up, Fred. Just a reminder too, if you want to listen to Space Nuts Q&A, that will be coming up on Monday. It'll get downloaded to your respective platforms automatically if you're subscribed to us. And if you're a follower on YouTube, don't forget to hit the subscribe button below. Thanks, Fred. We will catch up with you real soon.
Sounds great, Andrew. Talk soon.
Fred Watson, astronomer at large, and he joins us every week on Space Nuts. And I hope you'll join us again very, very soon. We'll catch you then. From me, Andrew Dunkley. Bye-bye.
Space Nuts. You've been listening to the Space Nuts podcast. Available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast player. You can also stream on demand at Bytes.com. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.